Hello and welcome to the Money Talk podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, our first of 2020, we're looking forward to the year ahead. And as luck would have it, the latest quarterly investment outlook from Fidelity is here to help us do exactly that. Its author, Tom Stevenson, joins me to talk it over. If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. 2020 has a tough act to follow. Last year was one of the best in recent memory for investment returns, leading many to now lower their expectations for markets in the next 12 months. Are they right to do so? To help answer that, I'm joined by Tom Stevenson, Investment Director here at Fidelity, and the author of our latest quarterly investment outlook, which assesses the prospects for different asset classes and regions in the months ahead. Tom, welcome along. I'm going to come in a moment to your forecasts, including your picks for the funds that we should be watching in 2020. But I wanted to start with the point I make there. 2019 was such a good year, wasn't it? Surely 2020 has to be tougher.
Yes, I mean, that's the sort of conventional wisdom, isn't it? That the market was so strong in 2019, the S&P 500 was up by almost 30%. I mean, it was a pretty remarkable year. And it wasn't just equities. Bonds did well. Commodities did well. Everything really across the board, gold and silver did well. So it was the kind of year that doesn't come along very often. And it's natural to think that we must be setting ourselves up for some sort of a correction. I think for various reasons, I'm not sure that is necessarily the case. I think if you look over a two-year view, which I think is quite helpful in this context, and you go back to January 2018, yes, you realise that actually we haven't come that far from there. We're a little bit above where we were 2 years ago, but not to the extent that you would think if you just looked at the last 12 months.
Yeah, we've done a lot of looking at 2019, obviously, as the year turns and you look back, and it's sort of one of the things that struck me is that it was the 20-25% year. You know, we had a good one in 2013. I think 1997 was a particularly good one.
Yeah,
but in general, it's sort of unremarkable on how good a year it's been. Had it been a 20% fall, it would be real sort of head in hand stuff, wouldn't it?
But it would, because they are quite unusual. I mean, I actually looked at the last 50 years, just recently, sort of on the back of this big rise last year. I thought, well, let's see how this looks in the context of half a century of returns. And actually, you get quite a lot of big movements. There have been 16 of the 50 years where the market has moved, this is the global market, MSCI World Index, has moved by more than 20% in a calendar year. But of those 16, 13 of them have been rises and only 3 of them have been falls. So if you do get a 20% fall, then it's only 6% of the time, it's 3 out of 50.
Yeah, it doesn't happen very often, but you really, really feel it. It's a lesson, isn't it, actually, in sort of loss aversion. We definitely feel losses way more than we feel the gains.
Yes, that's right. The pain of a loss is a great deal more than the equivalent sort of joy of the gain. That's human nature, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and I guess when people look at the big gains of last year, they should remember that those big successful years, they're there to kind of smooth out and offset the bad years or the years where markets go nowhere.
Yeah, so if you look at the average over that 50 years period, the average gain is about 8%. The average rise is quite similar to the average fall, actually, about 16% the average rise and about 14% the average fall. What makes investment such a good thing is that there are more of the rises than there are of the falls. It's not that there's a difference in scale particularly, it's just that the odds are stacked in your favour because there are many more winning years than losing years.
Indeed. Okay, well, let's take a closer look at some of the forecasts you're making in the outlook this time round. You're now positive on shares in general as an asset class compared to being only neutral 3 months ago. Now, why is that, given, as we've just been talking about, many stock markets are now higher than they were 3 months ago?
Yes, I think what happened last year, there were two key drivers of markets last year. The first was what happened with interest rates. So the Federal Reserve moved in the second half year between July and September. It made three quarter point cuts in interest rates. So that really sort of drew a line under the normalization of monetary policy and showed that the Fed was back on an easing bias. Now, it may not go any further in that direction in the short term, but it's a change of mindset at the Fed. So that was really important. The second important thing, of course, was the apparent easing in trade tensions towards the end of the year. Now, both of those happened in the second half of the year. And I think when I was writing 3 months ago, it was not clear exactly where we were. And certainly there wasn't much clarity on the trade front. So that's the difference. Yes, the market has risen, but I think the outlook has improved a lot. I think what we're looking at is a soft landing, economically speaking. And then if you put against that the relatively undemanding nature of valuations outside the US.
Yes.
The US is a different story. We might come to that. But, you know, generally speaking, valuations are not excessive. And I think we're going to get a soft landing. That's quite a good backdrop for shares in 2020.
Yeah. And conversely, you're negative on bonds. Now, they had a pretty good year last year as well. It's always a more complicated picture, I feel, with bonds. What's your thinking around the asset class now?
It's really to do again with interest rates, because I think yes, we've seen interest rates cut this year, but I think the long term picture for interest rates is that they've bottomed out at this kind of level. They've gone they're so low. I mean, in many cases, they're in negative territory. I think that the direction of travel for interest rates over the long haul must be up, and that's because I think the economy is improving. And I also think that there's a risk that inflation will come back into the picture. Mm-hmm. And partly that's because I think that the need to stimulate the economy is still there, but monetary policy has kind of run its course. And I think the emphasis is going to shift to fiscal policy, by which I mean spending by governments. We're seeing this in this country, we're seeing it in other countries. Governments are much more willing now to spend on infrastructure and services, and that ultimately is an inflationary impulse. That's going to push interest rates higher in the long run, and therefore I think that this what has been really a 40-year bull market in bonds, as interest rates have come down from very high levels in the early 1980s, I think that process has come to an end.
Are you calling the end of the bond bull market?
Well, I mean, and I wouldn't be the first person to do that, and I wouldn't be the first time that I've done it, to be completely candid. But yes, I think I probably am.
And I just wanted to dwell a bit of the sort of, you know, classroom lesson on this. Higher inflation and higher interest rates, that generally means higher yields on bonds. And that's inversely connected to the price. So the higher the yield, the lower the price. And that's what you're suggesting might happen.
Yeah, prices and yields move in opposite directions. So if you expect that yields to go up, then the natural consequence of that is that prices will come down.
Okay, well, let's go now to the regional breakdown for stock markets. And you mentioned it a moment ago, the US. It's been the engine room, hasn't it, for investment returns, not just last year, but actually for 10 years or more since the financial crisis. You're now neutral on the US. You were neutral on the US 3 months ago, but really in commentary, you're suggesting that the risks in the US have been rising.
Yes, I was really quite struck, actually, when I was preparing for this outlook, the scale of the outperformance by the US compared to other markets. So there was one chart I opened out, which actually was to illustrate what's happened in European stock markets. And the divergence in performance between the US stock market and the European stock markets is amazing, really. And what that's led to is a situation where most stock markets around the world actually have only just regained the levels that they reached at the top of the dot-com bubble 20 years ago in 2000.
The levels of indices.
The indices, the index levels. So, you know, they haven't really gone anywhere in 20 years. The one exception to that is the US, which is way above where it was then. And that is reflected in valuations. Now, you know, it's not quite as obvious in valuations because earnings have grown fast in the in the US as well. But it's also true in valuation terms that the US is much more expensive than other markets. And the gap, I think, is sufficiently wide now that I just think that we need to be a bit cautious about continuing to back the US. However, there is a counter-argument. There's always a counter-argument in these things. And we are entering a presidential election year. I think that's quite important. The fourth year in the presidential cycle is often quite a good year in markets because the incumbent president, especially if they're coming up for re-election, which is the case this time, really they'll make sure that they do anything to make sure that there isn't a crisis. So I think that the... So what President Trump has done with the trade situation is indicative of that. He's trying to smooth the way for a strong economy in election year. It doesn't quite tally, of course, with what he's doing in the Middle East. That's another story. But even there, you could argue that that's related to the election in terms of him, you know, making a show of strength. Yes, I think the US is expensive, but I think there are positives as well to offset that. So I'm not completely negative on the US at all. I'm broadly neutral.
It's hard, isn't it, with the US? Because if you look at it in a across a big timeline, you know, the last 10 years since the financial crisis, it's done it's ever so well. And the fact that this is the biggest market in the world, and if you're properly diversified, you should have the most exposure to that. It's been a fantastic sort of Goldilocks scenario for investors, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And you would think, you know, the valuations versus other stock markets are something's got to reverse now. But the America is full of really unique companies, and the tech ones are the easy ones to reach for here. You know, they're just doing things, creating markets almost for themselves in a way that no other companies seem to be doing. It's very difficult to know when that stops, how far it can go. It's a hard one.
Yes, and it would be a bold investor and a foolish investor, I think, that counted on the US no longer being the engine room of the global economy. And it's not so long ago, actually, that you look at the value of the Dow Jones index and the FTSE 100 index, and numerically, they were the same. And now, you know, there is a massive difference. You know, the Dow Jones index has done three times as well over a long period than the FTSE 100. Yeah. I wouldn't bet against the US.
Yeah, indeed. Now, there are a couple of places in the world where you're now positive versus 3 months ago. One of those is Asia and emerging markets. Maybe this actually ties in with that US story as well. In fact, this has led to you picking a new fund for 2020 in your picks for the year, and that's the Artemis Global Emerging Markets Fund. Why are you hopeful about emerging markets?
Yeah, it does tie in with the American story to an extent. I think there are a couple of reasons why I'm positive on emerging markets. One is the valuation story, that emerging markets have massively underperformed the US, and certainly the last couple of years, the trade situation has not been favourable to emerging markets. So on valuation grounds, it looks attractive. I think that a key driver of what happens in emerging markets is actually the level of the dollar. And when the dollar falls, or when emerging market currencies rise, that's often quite good for emerging markets. Rising emerging market currencies tends to depress inflation in those markets, which can be and often is a problem in emerging markets. And it allows the central banks in those emerging markets to reduce interest rates, which is obviously good news. And I think my gut feel is that the dollar is going to weaken over the next year or so, partly because of the sort of more accommodative stance of the Federal Reserve. So falling dollar, low valuations. And then the third thing is just the fundamental secular growth story in emerging markets has not gone away. And the growth, the middle class there, the consumption story is still very strong. So put those three together and it just feels like a good moment for emerging markets.
Because the investors haven't always had a nice time in emerging markets, have they? Often the story's always been there. It's always one of the most persuasive stories in the sort of global economic financial picture. But there's always seems to be some reason why emerging markets stumble. Presumably, it always comes with that caveat, right, that these are more volatile markets.
They are more volatile markets, but I think it fundamentally comes down to valuation. You know, if you buy markets when they are relatively cheap compared to their own history and compared to other markets, you stack the odds in your favour. And if you, conversely, if you buy them when they are expensive relative to those two, then you're stacking the odds against you. And at the moment, it just feels like it's a good time.
Yeah. Now, the other place in the world where you're now positive, having been neutral before, is the UK. Now, lots of people last year, I spoke to people last year, who said the UK was uninvestable for them because of the Brexit uncertainty. You and I have spoken before about how that Brexit uncertainty has not really gone away, truly. So why is it that you've now gone positive on the UK?
Well, again, this is a valuation case that I'm making. I think that we have to a certain degree reduced the uncertainty in the UK market. We now have a government which has got a majority which will allow it to push through its agenda. Now there are still lots of uncertainties, and we've talked about these around the Brexit process and around the deadline at the end of this year. That hasn't gone away. But I think the key difference in the UK is that the government has achieved its majority on the back of votes which the Prime Minister admits have been lent to the Conservative Party rather than given. And that, I think, is going to trigger a looser fiscal policy in the UK. And we're probably going to see the early signs of this at the budget in March. That in order to keep those voters on side, the government is going to have to spend on things that matter to those Midlands and Northern new Conservative voters. So it's things like transport, it's things like education and the health service and the police and all that. And all of that spending, I think, will fundamentally be good for the UK economy.
Yeah, sure. And of course, you're right. We do have uncertainty. We've got a couple of big moments this year coming up. In July, I think we've got this deadline for whether or not they're going to potentially extend this transition period, which Boris Johnson said, absolutely no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
We'll see. Who knows? And then you've got the moment at the end of the year. But
also got a moment in September, actually, which is really the deadline for coming up with a trade deal, because it needs to be signed off by the various governments around Europe, and that will take 3 months.
Yeah.
So there's a 6 month period between March and September when this has to be thrashed out.
But of course, what you won't have, and a positive probably for the UK versus last year, you won't have these moments driven by Westminster and Parliament where the government's own plans can be derailed. It can do what it needs to do.
Yeah.
We don't quite know exactly how it's going to approach it, but it's not going to be derailed by politics in quite the same way that it could have been last year.
Yeah, so that's true. And I think it becomes more of a sort of technical, sort of bureaucratic argument about trade and negotiations, and more of a civil service thing. It will come off the headlines, at least to start with. I think as we get closer to the end of the year, it will be back on the headlines.
Yeah, and so there is, on the back of all that, a UK fund among your picks for this year, and that is the Lion Trust UK Growth Fund. What was it that you liked there?
Yeah, so this is a nice sort of middle of the road fund. You know, if you look at the funds in the UK category of the Select 50, you know, they tend to have a sort of bit of a growth bias or a bit of a value bias. And the balance between those has changed over time. And it's not quite clear to me which of those investment approaches will win out. So that's why I like this fund, because it's a sort of plain vanilla down the middle sort of fund. you know, very well managed.
Well run, good record.
Good, yeah. It's a solid sort of core fund.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, now while we're talking about your fund picks, let's rattle off the remaining two from 2020. They're two Fidelity funds, and in fact, they're two funds that you've backed last year and now continue to back, and that's the Fidelity Global Dividend Fund and the Select 50 Balanced Fund, which is a fund of funds made up of funds selected in our Select 50 list. They've kept their place. They've performed well. Anything to say on those?
Again, solid funds. I think in an environment of low interest rates, I think that dividends, equity income will continue to be attractive. I like the global approach of that fund. And the Select 50 Balance Fund, I think in an uncertain environment, and of course, you know, we definitely live in an uncertain environment, I think that balance, it continues to be attractive. So of the four fund recommendations that we made last year, the 12 or so percent growth of the Select 50 Balance Fund was less than the pure equity funds. But that's exactly what it's designed to do. Mm. So for anyone looking for that sort of solid capital growth from a mixture of bonds and equities, then I think this remains a very attractive fund.
Okay. Finally then, Tom, you've used the start of a new decade, as we are now, to look even further forward than normal, to 2030, in fact, within the outlook this time, and what the next 10 years are going to bring. What are some of the themes that are going to keep us talking over the next decade?
Yes, I mean, I think overall, we should probably expect the next 10 years to be less exciting from an investment perspective than the last 10 years. And that's simply because we are starting from a higher, much higher base. Go back 10 years, it was 2009, it was the bottom of the market. And, you know, it was a fantastic starting point for an investment. You probably wouldn't choose to start from here if you could start from there. But that's, you know,
well, it never feels like it at the time, though, does it? I mean, no, once
and
you
it
just
didn't
had a,
then. It no, certainly didn't then.
You have a huge crisis, and that causes a crash. No one wants to invest. Of course, that's when you should be piling in.
Absolutely right. But there will be plenty of sort of big themes which will run through the last 10 years, just as they have. And some of them will be similar to the ones that we had. You know, technology will continue to be a very important theme. You know, we're all going to spend more and more time on electronic devices. 500 billion internet-enabled connected devices, it's estimated, by the end of this decade. So technology will be important. I think climate change will be a very important driver, and it will also have an influence on the types of funds which people want to invest in. I think that, you know, socially responsible environmental funds will be important. And I think other important drivers, demographics is going to be a very, very big driver. The global population is aging fast. There are going to be more grandparents than children by 2030. You know, that's going to be a significant influence on spending patterns, for example. So lots of interesting themes coming up over the next 10 years.
And one that I was interested in that you've written about, which was, and this seems very uncertain, but people have spoken a lot in the last year about a sort of divergence in the sort of global economy. We've assumed for years and years and years that we're going to get closer together, more globalised and more interconnected. But you see at the geopolitical level the prospects for particularly China going its own way in terms of an internet, basically, that works for China and not the rest of the world.
Yeah, the splinternet, it's called. Yeah. And I think that's a really fascinating trend, because for 30 or 40 years, it's gone the other way.
Yeah.
You know, we have moved towards a more globalized world in which there's freedom of movement of capital and people and ideas. And I think that, you know, with the election of Donald Trump, with Brexit, you know, we have reached something of a watershed. We're moving towards a more nationalistic, regionalized world. And I think, what you said there about the internet is a really good example of that. You know, if we end up with, you know, a China-dominated internet and a US-dominated internet working separately in two separate sort of silos, that's not what anyone
and
expected.
It's important. Yes, and if you were looking at the prospects for the biggest companies, the big tech companies in America, that suddenly circumscribes their potential market in a much smaller way than if everything's just up for grabs and Google can do its thing in, you know,
it
China
does, and it also means that the types of businesses which will do well are probably different from the types of businesses that do well in a globalized environment where cheap labor and, you know, speed of movement and freedom of movement is important. Yeah. And maybe other things will have their time in the sun.
Okay, well, we will no doubt be talking on these themes and others a lot more from now. That's all we have time for now. Listeners should know that the Outlook is available in many and varied forms. There's a printed and downloadable digital version. And you also recorded a live webcast with Q&A, and all of that is going to be available at the Markets and Insights section of the fidelity.co.uk website.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week. Please be aware that the value of investments and the income you get from them can go down as well as up, so you may not get back what you invest. This information doesn't constitute investment advice and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision, nor should it be treated as a recommendation for any investment. Eligibility to invest in an ISA or a pension and the value of tax savings depends on personal circumstances, and all tax rules may change. You will not normally be able to access money held in a pension until the age of 55. Reference to specific securities or funds should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities or funds and is included for the purpose of illustration only. Fidelity Personal Investing does not give personal recommendations. If you're unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to an authorised financial advisor.